Hi, folks. This is the CyberWays podcast, and we translate our academic knowledge about information security into stuff that you can use as a security professional. We think it's a unique mission. We think you'll like it. I'm Tom Stafford.
I'm Craig Van Slyke. Tom and I are your hosts on your journey to knowledge. CyberWays is brought to you by the Louisiana Tech College of Business's Center for Information Assurance. The center offers undergraduate and graduate certificate programs in cybersecurity and sponsors academic research focused on behavioral aspects of cybersecurity and information privacy.
Well, welcome into another edition of CyberWays. It's a podcast that makes academic cybersecurity research relevant to the security practitioner. It's a production of the Louisiana Tech College of Business and the Center for Information Assurance. With help from the Just Business Grant, courtesy of Dean Chris Martin. Today, we're going to have a new twist. I'm going to interview my co-host, Dr. Van Slyke. He's the McAllister Eminent Scholar of Information Systems here at Louisiana Tech. He's been in academics over 20 years after a decade in industry, and his research focuses on behavioral aspects of information systems, more specifically into behavioral aspects of cybersecurity lately, because that's what we do at Tech. We're both going to talk a bit about why users don't care about information security, but this podcast centers on a talk he recently gave to the university community here based upon an article he recently published in Computers and Security that gives us some insight into why complacency may arise and perhaps what we could do about it. So that Computers and Security article is explaining the interactions of humans and artifacts in insider security behaviors, The Mangle of Practice Perspective in Computers and Security, Volume 90. I remember, Craig, you talking about Mangle of Practice. I did not realize this is where it was applied. Fascinating reading this article. But more importantly, it's something that practitioners need to think about because it deals with what I've just been lecturing my students about from your textbook, Chapter 8 on Cybersecurity. Security is everybody's job, but you got to make them want to do it because people are very relaxed about it in the workplace, I'm wondering, tell me, at a high level in the description of your paper and its results, why don't users care about security?
Well, you know, I guess I would push back on that notion that it's everybody's job. You know, when you and I get our annual evaluation, it's, do we teach well? Do we do research well? Do we provide service to the university? It's not.
And did we not open that phishing email, right?
Yeah, did you change your password, you know, and that sort of thing. And so really, users get paid to do a job. And sure, at some level, it's everybody's job not to do things that are too stupid. Matter of fact, we just got one of those, actually a couple of emails today.
Yeah.
About a new phishing attempt. Users do have some responsibility, but this idea that we can push, you know, a lot of the responsibility, the majority of the responsibility onto users, I think is just fundamentally flawed. You know, users get paid for doing their jobs, not for doing our jobs.
For programming applications, for running a network, for tuning a database, right? I get you. The same time, I was speaking to a group of students in our Intro to IS class, the one that I teach with your book. Which is an excellent book, by the way. Practitioners couldn't hurt from taking a look at it because it's very practical. But what I was telling them was, well, some of you are going to end up in the C-suite, and it'll be your job to be concerned with cybersecurity all day and all night long. But you need to find a way to make sure the people that report to you and the people that work in the workplace have an incentive to not do the stupid stuff that gets the company in trouble, because it's the basic level user that opens that wrong email and lets a ransomware attack into the company and locks up the database. That's what I meant right. By being everybody's job. Everybody's got to at least be aware of the possibility of one wrong keystroke or mouse click hurting the company quite a bit, even though it's not their job to be watching out for security.
Right. And I was being a little bit facetious at one level. But, you know, I think, and I see this in the literature, and I see this sometimes in the trade press, where there's this adversarial relationship. You know, users are a group to be controlled. We need to keep users from doing things. We need to constrain them. And I think that's the wrong mindset. It needs to be a partnership where we find, as security professionals, we find ways for them to be secure and to avoid risks while doing their jobs with minimal constraints from security controls.
Well, bravo. That's exactly what I've been thinking. the notion that we're busy and we're distracted is one thing, but the idea that careless behavior could wreck the company is another. I think the notion of our research to this point in our field as academics has been focused on finding the bad elements inside the company, the insider threat perspective. And you and I both have been expanding into an insider threat perspective that deals with why people inside the company are a threat, but not intentionally so. The notion of psychopathy and the bad element being the people you have to ferret out and punish, or to use, Alan Johnston or John Darcy's approach, make it painful enough for people to contemplate doing wrong things. That's nice, but it treats the rest of the workforce as a criminal when they're not, and that can de-incentivize, is my concern.
Well, yeah, and I'll draw a parallel to your new puppy. You know, if you're overly strict with that dog and you beat it, not that you ever would, of course, but, you know, if you treat it really badly and punish it every time it turns around, you'll have a dog that won't do anything.
It won't be a good dog, and it'll be sitting in the corner scared. You got a good point there.
That's right. You know, when you train a dog, it's a partnership between the human and the dog. And I'll come back to that. We need to have a partnership.
Yes, I like the partnership rubric.
You brought up the nefarious users. That's such a tiny proportion of our user base.
1% or less, based on what I've seen.
Yeah, and my guess would be 1% would be the pretty strong upper limit,
mm-hmm, the top
on
end,
it in
right.
Most organizations. And so, you know, do we really want to build everything around that 1% while we're constraining the rest of the organization? Because there's a cost to that. You know, if you prevent people from flowing into their jobs and get in their way, you know, there's an overhead there that doesn't get accounted for very well, but it's still there.
And you also have the problem of unanticipated outcomes. When you expect the worst, sometimes your fears are confirmed, even though people aren't prepared to do the worst. Sort of a negative halo effect, I guess. Self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, we see that with some of the neutralization work, in the academic literature, where people are going to be really good at coming up with excuses of why they knowingly violated policies.
Because the boss is mean. The boss is too stern.
Right.
The boss is strict. You know, a lot of this devolves back to the very basics of organizational behavior research. And in the modern day, people tend to think that that managers who are consultative, supportive, and reinforced with positive reinforcers get better, more dedicated employees than the ones who crack the whip and use negative reinforcement.
Right. And I think it even goes beyond that. It's that idea of friction. So, you know, in economics, transaction costs, you know, when you go to buy something and there's a cost of handling the payment and a cost of keeping the lights on and that sort of thing, you know, that are just costs that you just as soon do without, but you have to have. Security is like that. And so our goal should be to try to minimize that friction for workers, not just from a cost standpoint, a financial cost standpoint, but also from a well-being standpoint for the users. Users are going to find a way to get their work done.
There were a couple of things I wanted to touch on from a practical standpoint that are in your paper. One is the mangle of practice, but the other in the presentation that you gave to the university community was the notion of rational ignorance. And I thought, I've heard that term before. Isn't that the name of a podcast somewhere?
Yes, it was the original name of a podcast, which is now Live Well and Flourish. But
Okay. I liked rational ignorance, but I didn't realize
saw
the definition that it came from the economic literature. And I think it speaks to the point you're trying to make about we have a job to do, but the devil's in the details.
Well, look, we've all either complained ourselves or heard people complain about the annual information security training that most organizations have. You know, I mean, you do it, you get through it, you complain about it, and then you forget most of it right away. You know, users really don't want to spend much time figuring out security risks. So when the idea behind rational ignorance is when you face a situation where you might have some uncertainty, you might want to gather information, you do a cost-benefit analysis. And if the cost of gathering and processing that information exceeds the potential benefit or the anticipated benefit, not potential benefit, anticipated benefit of that information, you don't engage in information seeking. So the idea is, you said, Tom, comes out of political economics, Anthony Downs in the 1950s. And he used it to look at voter behavior. You know, voters do things like voting along party lines, or they're single issue voters because it reduces their information search costs. You know, I don't need to look at everything about every candidate. I'm going to vote for the Democrat, or I'm going to vote for the Republican, or I'm going to vote for the one who's pro this or anti that. And so we see the same thing in information security. Yeah, I mean, I could spend some time as a user trying to understand what all the risks are, but what's the benefit? You know, is that information really going to pay dividends to me? And the answer is often no. So one thing that we have to do is make it a lot easier for users to understand how to be secure. I mean, you have one of my favorites, Tom. Don't click on links.
Yeah.
You get an email with a link in it, don't click on it.
We spent quite a lot of time talking about that in class, and I used the example of the email from Danny Shells, and I almost went into I actually gave the example of when I clicked on a link in a whale phishing exploit from the president of the university, purporting to be from the president, about a committee I sat on, and realized it was an exploit when it asked me to download the Adobe Reader, and I knew I had a full copy of Adobe Pro on my machine already. And I used that as by way of saying, anybody can screw this stuff up. It's very easy. They try to make it easy. My concern is how we incent our workers to be the kind of organizational citizen who wouldn't want the company to be exploited even by carelessness, and at the same time, overcome this the sense that it's a lot of busy work to keep up with the training in particular, because you make that point, the training is boring, it's dry, it's dull. It's an imposition on work time and productivity, but also in being good, let's call them security citizens or organizational citizens, and acting with the best interests of the company in mind, even though they're not always fully incented to do so. I guess that's the challenge I see from a manager or motivation standpoint.
Well, and I'll be a little bit provocative again. Sometimes maybe acting according to security policy doesn't have the best interest of the company in mind. So, you know, the classic example is somebody who's going out on the road and they want to take some data with them so they can, you know, be able to put proposals together, whatever it is that they want to do while they're on the road. Well, you know, the company prohibits that, but they find a way around it. Maybe instead of using a thumb drive, they email it to themselves, or they upload it to Dropbox or whatever they might do. Well, they're trying to do the right thing for the company.
By being productive and making the most of their time, taking a shortcut.
And the fact of the matter is, I mean, I don't know any research on this, but my guess would be that the vast majority of the time, that it is actually better for the company because the data aren't compromised. You know, we only hear about the exceptions when the data are compromised, but you know, for every one of those, there are probably 100 where the data is not compromised. And so, you know, this idea of having the best interest of the company at heart, in the employee's mind, that might be violating security policies. If security policies get in the way of doing what they think is best for the company.
I should say I'm in the middle of analyzing data, and it's taken me 2.5 years, I think, William Lee's dissertation that we conducted over at a major multinational telecom provider, dealt with the notion of work groups having their own internal informal security rules that often were in slight, if not full abrogation of the company's security policies. All in favor of internal work group efficiencies. They knew that they were secure in the work group. They knew that they weren't going to harm anybody in the work group. They knew that following the policies verbatim were slowing the work group down. They weren't making deadlines. It made them look not as productive. And I contrast that to a classified workforce across the state that I also studied, which was exactly the opposite. They were entirely regimented, and we followed it, dotted every I and crossed every T, because North Korea could get the secrets if we didn't. And where do we find the middle ground? Oh, I wanted to say the mangle of practice. That's a zingy term. I like grabby terms like that in our alliterations. Tell me about this mangle of practice, how it applies to security.
Well, so it's a very, very academic concept that I won't bore our listeners with.
Was that Stephen Alter or maybe Fred?
No, I can't think of his first name. Pickering.
Oh, okay.
It's a theory of socio-materiality, which is how people and things come together. And so what the basic idea is that you can't just look at the kind of material thing, the artifact, like a security control, and you can't just look at the person. You have to look at how the two come together. The metaphor comes from a laundry mangle. You remember the old laundry bins that had the roller thing? That roller thing is called a mangle.
And they break the buttons on your shirt?
Yeah. And so, you know, when you pull, I've never used one, but when you pull it, you put two pieces of fabric through to squeeze all the water out. Mm-hmm. Well, those two pieces of fabric kind of become one until you pull them back apart. And so that's supposed to be the metaphor. But the idea is that when you are out there in the world, you have some goal. And what makes an object or a policy or a technology what it is how you use it. So, for example, if I'm out in the pasture and I need to drive a nail in a goat toy and I don't have a hammer, I pick up a rock. Well, it's a rock, but it's also a hammer. And so the idea is that when we've got some goal and we encounter resistance to that goal from some element of the environment, like a security control, we seek accommodation. We try to find some way to go around that resistance to achieve our goal. So I don't have a hammer. I look around. I have this rock that can afford me the opportunity to drive a nail. And so that's the accommodation that I'm finding. And what happens is when users get resistance from some security control, they'll keep trying to find ways around it until one of three things happen. They either find a way around it and they achieve their goal. They modify the goal so that they can work around the security control, or they give up. And the thing is, none of those are really good for the organization, because if they find a way around the security control, that has risks. If they modify the goal, assuming the goal was for the good of the organization to begin with, that's not ideal either. And so I think we need another mindset shift from finding ways to stop users from doing risky things to providing ways for users to do their jobs that are safe.
But at the same time, it sounds like you're implying that security gets in the way of getting the work done if people are being motivated to find the workarounds. And I'm a big student of workarounds. I think they go on all the time. I explain to my students how I write down my passwords and ID information when I'm advising, because it's repetitive to have to type it in, and I don't set my computer to remember them for security reasons, but I'm also not looking them up every time. How does the manager incent those people that feel like it's righteous to bypass security in the name of aiding the company in terms of productivity?
Well, I think it's not so much a matter of incentive. It's a matter of rethinking the controls. So, for example, in our advising system, no activity timeout is pretty short, which can be aggravating when you're looking back and forth between the system and some form and talking with a student and looking at the schedule of classes. Then you get logged out again and you've got to go back through. Well, if you want the user to not write things down, you find a different way to do that. Mm-hmm. You extend the login, you have a quick pin where it's just, you know, faster way to get into the system. I don't know what it is, but, you know, how are you going to incent somebody to not write their password down? You know, there are costs to that. How are you going to monitor it? How are you going to find out whether or not they're doing it? You know, it's a bit of a mess, which is why we're in the situation we're in now.
passwords are a perennial problem because they're getting more complex and they're getting more extended, and we're required to change them so often. I found myself thinking, because I watch the news for what's happening with AI and such out there, facial recognition being a big thing now in airports and security checkpoints. Why we can't have software that has our webcam recognize the user at the computer and automatically authenticate without us having to type all this stuff in. I mean, that might be too easy, really, but I'm just thinking out loud because I'm looking right at my webcam right now wondering how come it can't recognize me doing that. I do that with my phone. Log into my bank account, look at my phone. My phone sees my face, and my goodness, it's almost like I shouldn't be doing that because it's too easy.
And I think Windows might have that facility. I'm not sure about that, but no, there's got to be a different way of doing it, because you're right. You know, if you want people to not reuse passwords and you don't provide them with a password manager, a secure password manager, you know, what are they going to do? There's a reason people reuse passwords, because it's hard to remember unique passwords. So I really want to come back to that mindset shift. Controls, by their very nature, constrain people, constrain users. So if we can start migrating towards accommodating users and really have that partnership with users where we find ways for them to get their work done, I think we're all better off and we're more secure.
That was where I was coming from when I used the rubric of security is everybody's job. It's something we used to say when I was a marketing professor. It's everybody's job to be customer-oriented. I kind of feel a part of me, it's everybody's job to make sure the company doesn't get exploited, given that we use sensitive resources. Hey, I want to turn back to your article, because in talking about the mangle of practice as a scientific thing, you have a figure on page 6, your figure 1, that outlines some of the causality and flow and intervening factors in this mangle process, the initial action through to the final reaction end outcome, the action, and then the resistance accommodation interplay. Could you speak to that a little bit in case there's a listener out there who wants to go and read the academic stuff and put it to a practical application in the workplace?
What we do when we want to achieve some goal is we look around to see if we can find things that will afford us a path towards that goal. Like my picking up a rock to use it as a hammer. Mm-hmm. Example.
Using a post-it note for my password when I'm advising.
That's right. And so, you also have to consider resistance. So some things will offer affordances and some things will offer resistance. And there's this dance that goes on when users hit a security control where they encounter the resistance from the security control. And they try to find a way around it. They try to find an accommodation, a new affordance. And that goes back and forth and back and forth until we end up with one of the three outcomes, the goal being achieved, modified, or abandoned. So it's really a pretty straightforward idea. Where it gets a little more academic is that the material thing that, you know, the control in this case, and even this system that's providing the affordance, is actually shaped by the user. So your post-it note, all of a sudden it isn't a post-it note anymore, it's a password manager.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. And so
external cognitive storage is what we used to call it.
That's exactly right. External memory aid. Yep.
Yeah.
But a post-it note, you know, it can be a lot of things. It can be something that you put up on the refrigerator as a reminder. It can be something where it's an external memory aid. It can be a password manager. It can be a threat vector. And so we need to think about security controls and systems in the same way. You know, they aren't one thing. They're how they're used is what makes them what they are. And that's the mangle of practice perspective. And they actually shape who we are, which gets a lot thicker than we probably want to get into in a podcast for security professionals, but that's all on the paper. And I'm happy to send the paper to anybody who would like to read it.
But circling back to the rational ignorance process and then springboarding off of a question from one of our recently graduated doctoral students who's doing work on cyber complacency. You gave me a figure here that began with an external construct of security concerns and passed through a process of rational ignorance leading to an assessment of benefits and costs and the decision to acquire or not acquire information. And your marginal note on this was hyperbolic discounting. I wanted to go back to hyperbolic discounting because that's another zingy concept that just is interesting to think about.
So, it really is, it's an interesting concept in a lot of ways, but it really has a lot of applicabilities to security. So think about what has to happen for there to be actual harm when I violate a security policy or work around a control. So when you write your password down on a sticky note, somebody's got to get into your office. They've got to notice that sticky note. They've got to discern somehow that that's a password. And they've got to figure out what account it's a password to. And then they've got to figure out what your user ID is. And so all of those things have probabilities that are less than one. And you start multiplying all of those less than one probabilities, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what we do mentally is the further out in the future some risk is or some gain, the more we discount it.
And so what's the chance of that thought in the user's mind?
That's exactly right. And so they know that the benefit of violating a security policy, that's fairly immediate and fairly knowable for them.
Getting her done, yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have tried to seek accommodation. You know, they know what they're trying to accomplish. But the reality is that any single violation of a security policy or workaround to a control carries a risk that's approaching zero. Now, you know, there are obviously...
Psychologically speaking, it's the beginning of a slippery slope as well. If you get used to doing it here, you can get used to doing it there, and it could eventually be less than hyperbolic in terms of the probability of something happening.
Well, that's exactly right, because doing something 100% of the time is easier than doing it 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Because if you only do it 99%, then you're going to do it 98, you're going to do it 97. Mm-hmm. You know, every time makes it easier to do that thing again. We really need to look at this through the user's eyes. And as you pointed out early on, not view users as these bad actors, but view them as people that are trying to get their work done.
And they don't need a lot of distractions if we can find ways to avoid distracting them.
That's right.
Not to say security is distracting, but maybe that training rubric from earlier is an example.
And there are a lot of things that we can do. So, for example, I think if we came up with 3 or 4 good rules, that's it. You know, not 2 hours of training. Mm. But don't click on links,
right.
Use a password manager, make sure you have, you know, two-factor authentication enabled, you know,
and shred
I don't know
what they
notes.
Are.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, I do want to tell notes. An anecdote about that, because in this very discussion out of your Chapter 8 yesterday, I told the students I'm writing down passwords on Post-it notes when I advise because of the timeout. And then I said, I heard a very qualified ex-NSA guy speak to my security conference about the threat is not so much your system getting brute force cracked, it's the bad actors hiring your janitor to go around and see if you left a Post-it note up, to look in your trash can, to socially engineer, to take advantage of people
taking
the easy step, because the social engineering is the threat. I mean, even phishing is social engineering in a sense, but there are people inside our organization who are incented by external bad actors to snoop around and see what they can find.
But when we, and I'm going to go a little bit further here than I believe is the real state of affairs, but when we treat all users as being bad actors, you know, I don't think we get anywhere. And no. I don't really think that security professionals do that, but when you start talking about punishments and sanctions and, you know, that have overly tight controls, you're kind of assuming that. You're trying to prevent the bad actors and also people from doing inadvertent risky things. But
I'm reminded of the old World War II security rubrics of loose limbs sink ships, or the walls have ears, just because there were a lot of espionage agents in industrial manufacturing just listening to pick up secrets. And so being aware that somebody might follow along behind you, and just cleaning up your workplace when you go home, locking your workstation, shredding your post-it notes. You can't help doing that stuff because you got to get work done, but being lazy and leaving it for somebody to come find could sink the ship, as it were, back in World War II.
Well, and I view those kinds of security policy violations or bad practices as being diagnostics. So if people are having to write down passwords, or if people are trying to, you know, email files to themselves, then you need to provide a password manager or some passwordless authentication system, if there is such a thing.
Or in the design process, usability has not been properly considered if the system is not that easy to use securely. Somebody didn't look into the requirements and the usability necessities of the early design process, perhaps.
Well, it's almost like the old story about the architect who built a new building and didn't put any sidewalks in. And then, so where are the sidewalks? He said, well, we're going to wait 2 months, and wherever the worn parts of the grass are, that's where we'll put sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when people walk across the grass or when people take risky actions, that's a diagnostic that you're providing some kind of resistance without a safe accommodation.
Hey, back to the earlier point I made about our doctoral student, Sahar, having a question about security complacency and trust, and me trying, and she was asking to relate it back to my IEEE article that we've talked about on this podcast before on cyber complacency. And my response to her was, I don't think trust is really in there. Trust is kind of transactional. Do you think somebody's going to defraud you? But then I thought about it further, and it occurred to me that maybe she meant, do I feel complacent because I work in a well-designed, secure workplace, and I don't have to be careful because the system is careful for me? Do you think that that's a threat?
It could be. I mean, the thing about trust is that it's only a problem when it's miscalibrated.
Hmm.
So if you trust somebody you shouldn't, you're exposed to unnecessary risk. If you don't trust somebody you should, you suffer unnecessary monitoring costs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the trick is to get it right. And so if users know how far they should trust the system, and by the same token, if we figure out how much we should trust users, then, you know, we can reduce the unnecessary risks or we can reduce the monitoring costs. And I think we can increase the level of trust that we can have in users by giving them safe accommodations to get their work done, not forcing them into workarounds.
Yeah, I believe so. I'm also reminded of the classified workplace I was alluding to that I did some interviews in, where that system's got network analytics running with AI additions to it, and you could almost assume nothing bad's going to get through and might become complacent just because you're so well screened, when in fact their biggest problem, as related to me in the interviews, was a jailbroke iPhone getting something into the company behind the firewall, where it doesn't matter how well things are filtered. Something got in there because somebody ignored a rule about unauthorized instruments in the workplace.
Yeah. No, it's tough. You know, the security professionals have a really hard job, and, you know, you have to have some sympathy for them, but you also have to have some sympathy for the workers who are trying to get their jobs done.
If they're not happy, they're not going to do what they should. They're going to suboptimize. They're going to, what's the quiet quitting is the term they're using these days to speak about what people do when they don't feel like they're being treated right in the workplace. I strongly feel you got to treat everybody as well as you want to be treated yourself, because that's how you get your best performance. And besides, it's the golden rule. Right. But at the same time, in large corporations, it's difficult for things like that to promulgate the corporate culture.
It is.
I'm minded to circle back to our practical aspect in this podcast and ask you how to help the listener take something from your thinking on the mangle of practice and the notion of complacency and the costs of security interfering with the necessity of the job.
Well, one of the things that I would try to do is to try to identify where the common policy violations or risky behaviors that you can identify are the result of trying to get work done, and then see how security can be reconsidered in a way that allows users to do their work in a safer manner. So that goes back to that diagnostic that I mentioned earlier. The second thing I would do is rethink training. I mean, look, I don't know about our listeners, but anybody who works for a state government, you know, goes through every year training on a variety of topics, and it's the same thing every year. Let's just say it is not the most productive experience that we'll have. And so think about your security training. Is your security training like that? Are you just piling, you know, for every risk that pops up, are you adding another thing to your security training, another thing to your training, another thing to your training, where, you know, it's unduly long and complex? Because I'll tell you, if you give them too much to remember, they'll remember nothing. Mm. And so you need to give them, like I go back to that, 3 or 4 good rules, simple to remember, simple to apply. You might find that it's much better off to just rethink and maybe get rid of some of that detail. I mean, we have to go through hazardous material handling training every year. You know, I don't handle hazardous
not
material.
Not any radioactives.
Yeah, you know.
Caustic solvents.
I mean, hot coffee would be the most hazardous material I have. So, you know, treating everybody the same can be a problem too. You know, you need to have more extensive training for people that maybe have access to more sensitive data or more sensitive systems. But really, that idea of just piling on more and more and more to the training as new threats arise is a losing proposition in the long run. See if you can streamline it. You know, we see that with our students. I always say I'll tell students, you know, this is what I want you to remember 6 months from now. You know, and it's always a relatively small number of things out of a 40-something hour class. And users are the same way. You give them too much, they won't remember any of it.
One way to incent people who are using the productivity workaround, taking short steps against security to achieve work group goals, is to remind them, if your security workaround ends up compromising your system, your productivity is going to be shot also. I don't know if it's practical to train that or not, but it would be well worth considering it, myself at least, as an individual user, realizing if I'm not too careful about my passwords or anything, I'm not going to be able to get my research done because my computer is going to be a brick.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there are consequences when security gets compromised. But remember that hyperbolic discounting.
Mm-hmm. Didn't happen this time. That's an important concept. That goes into the lecture tomorrow.
And it probably won't happen next time, or the time after that, or the time after that.
But it's ruinous when it does happen is the issue. The infrequent occurrence is always traumatic.
It is. I mean, more so for some organizations than others, but it's never a good thing, that's for sure. Anybody who's ever had their identity stolen knows. But that's a low probability event, but boy, if it happens to you, it is a pain.
And I can't buy a car without unlocking all 3 of my credit profiles, all of which I keep locked because I was one of the Equifax exploits. How long has that been? It should never have happened. This is the one company that should never have an exploit. And so it's very difficult to buy things on credit when you keep your credit profile locked up. But if your stuff's out there, if you don't keep it locked, people will be buying things, but you'll have to pay for them eventually.
Yeah, it's a risky world out there, yeah. That's for sure.
So anyway, for our listeners, we've been expanding from a piece of research from Vance Like and Bélanger, explaining the interactions of humans and artifacts in insider security behaviors, the Mangala Practice Perspective in Computers and Security, Volume 99. It's a scientific look at an eminently practical concept, how to keep people secure when it's either boring or not highly motivating to do so, that hyperbolic discounting we've been talking about. This has been Cyberways. It's a production of the Louisiana Tech College of Business Center for Information Assurance. And it is important to say that the Cyberways podcast is funded through the Just Business Grant Program of the Louisiana Tech College of Business. And we're grateful for that.
So join us next time on the Cyberways podcast, which is available on all major podcast platforms. We want you to subscribe or follow or whatever button your favorite podcast app has. Thank you very much.